Welcome, everyone, to episode 38. I am joined today by Leg Day, who is, Overwatch Contenders commentator, doing a little bit of Valorant as well. And I feel like I've seen you mention some other esports on Twitter. So
vaguely mentioned CS at points.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. But we're going to learn a lot about you in today's hour-long podcast. And I am looking to just get into it. So tell us how you got started in esports.
Interesting. Well, I wanted to be a player first. I think most of us who got into casting wanted to be players first.
Yeah.
And sometimes you cut the mustard and sometimes you don't. And I was in the category of not doing so. I was the captain, the main tank of Wu Tank Clan over on Overwatch Open Division. And it went fairly well. But at the same time, I'd really got into streaming, and it sort of transitioned from streaming that people just wanted me to talk about their games as well. And I suppose the first thing I did when it came to casting was essentially casting for the death, which sounds bad, but when we had a lot of friends who were playing a game and there was no space in the party, I would like join the game and watch, and I'd like try and speed type casting of the gameplay just to do something while I was watching. And then eventually from that, we ended up doing some pugs, and when there were too many people, I opted to rotate out and go into the spectator slot and just like stream a POV and talk over it quite a bit. So I guess that's how I got my first taste of like casting as an activity rather than like casting as a job. But when it came to casting as a job, it came back to being a pro player again. I ran double duty on something called the Overwatch University League back when things could be called a league before OWL launched. And I kind of burnt the midnight oil with it. I would play in the EU division, and then me and one of my mates who I was playing with, who went on to be a bit more successful as a pro, would go over to the North American games, and we'd cast them after we finished playing. So I suppose that was like the first like casting as a show experience that I had.
Okay. So I kind of fell into it after trying to make it as a pro. It is a familiar story. Most people do just kind of fall into it. I haven't had too many people say that they were just like, no, I wanted to be a commentator. And I directly like geared my goals towards it. So when did you first get picked up and I guess paid by Blizzard, basically? Because I'm a bit murky as far as how Contenders worked out. I was paying attention to Overwatch League when it first came out, and Overwatch as well, and obviously a very big deal, but didn't really watch the B, I guess, not B stream, but just the not Overwatch League,
yeah.
Contenders. I knew it was happening. I knew everyone was really excited for it as well, because they were looking for some type of ladder system that really was missing and is still missing from a lot of esports. But how did that work out for you?
It's a story of vaguely illegal piracy.
Oh. Okay, then.
It was just like, I was just doing occasionally, like in all esports, I suppose, we have like tournaments that go on in places like China or in Thailand that don't have English streams, and people are still interested in the matches. So I kind of endeared myself to a community by like screen grabbing the tournament stream and just casting over it.
Yep.
So that's what I call vague piracy.
There's a lot of that in esports, I would say. It's a bit of a murky gray area, I guess.
Yeah.
They didn't seem to have any
plans for English stuff. So I figured I'd just do that because I wanted to. So I wanted to see the teams as well. And that kind of endeared me to the community. And it seems somebody at Blizzard Europe offices watched or at least heard about those broadcasts. And then when they were hiring for the new Contenders product that they were setting up in 2018, I just got an email and they had me audition with my regular casting partner at the time, who was called Ham Tornado or Evie Fung.
Oh, yeah.
And had me audition with Jaws, who's now working on Overwatch League. And Jaws and I got picked up as a duo, although we were both play-by-plays at the time. But Jaws was a far more experienced play-by-play. He'd been casting for like a year and a half longer than I had and been successful in like some mobile titles and League of Legends, whereas I was the street urchin of casters. I was fairly inexperienced and imprecise with my craft, but I was pretty good at the game. So we settled upon me just trying out the color casting role. So that's how I ended up getting into sort of professional Overwatch casting. I entirely changed my roles before the first professional broadcast.
Nice. Yeah. So you actually started off as a play-by-play, you would say. That's kind of an interesting twist on things. Usually if you start off as a pro, you're kind of your intuition trying to, you know, cast over these clan wars and cast over these VODs or whatever you end up doing is to bring, you know, the intel and say like, oh, I'm pretty good at this game, so that's what I'm going to go off of. But you actually went directly into play-by-play and then had to switch?
Yeah, I'd say it's because I was kind of like juggling streaming at the same time. And so I felt like, just from a layman's perspective, I thought, okay, play-by-play is going to be more exciting for when I'm generally crafting these experiences solo. Like, I wanted to create a more exciting and engaging product from a solo cast. And to do that, I kind of just fell into play-by-play by accident because, like, the craft is very raw at the beginning. I was very tired after doing a play-by-play segment, so I didn't really have time to pace out some proper color points and be able to really explain everything and out of the pacing. So it was kind of like it's kind of like interval training in exercise. Just like start, stop, start, stop, and just keep doing the play-by-play segments.
Yeah, interesting. Did you have any I guess interest in any other esports before Overwatch came out? Were you playing a lot of other competitive games before then?
No, Overwatch was even my first shooter. I was I was actually an MMO addict before I got into Overwatch. So it wasn't even WoW as well. It was Star Wars: The Old Republic. So there was no scene around it. I was just addicted to the gameplay loop. As devious bastards making that level up sound full dopamine for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd never even considered esports as something that I'd be into prior to doing Overwatch. I guess I sort of fell into it by accident by just picking up Overwatch like in the open beta and being like, I like this game. I want to be really good at this game. I'm going to see how the best people play this game. So I ended up finding some tournament VODs. And at first I was watching it to learn, and then I was just watching it for fun after that.
Right. Yeah. I feel like it's, you know, very easy thing when people didn't get into esports until around 2010 to be like, oh, I didn't even know it existed. I had no idea about any of these games. Or maybe I heard about it, but I didn't really know about it. But it felt like after 2010, the rise of StarCraft and Twitch primarily, you had 2012 come in with like League of Legends and CS Global Offensive. And it felt like esports really took off at the time that Overwatch came out. And I think it was already very popular knowing about esports and Overwatch League very shortly after that. Obviously, a lot of people figured something like it was going to come out. So to have someone who kind of comes in to around 2015 and is still just like, no, not really into esports is, for me, a bit surprising. Like,
I barely even registered that it existed.
Like, yeah, you knew it existed, but you didn't watch very much.
Yeah, well, like I assumed that every game just had like its ranked queue. Which was what I was aware of. And I was like, that's esports. this seems like esports.
So did you have any experience with any type of commentating, like on camera? You know, do you do drama, theater? Do you listen to like a football broadcast or soccer over there, right? Any of
I'm
that?
Not even a sports fan. I had no sports broadcast to go off either, but I was trained in music and I do love a little bit of theater. I consider myself quite a theatrical caster. And I suppose that's where I drew most of my inspiration from. I love doing things like voice acting and I love singing. So I already had fairly okay control over my voice, even if it was quite imprecisely wielded in the earlier stages. So I guess that's where most of my casting mojo came from. If we have like a resource pool that we pull from to cast, mine is definitely theatricality.
Gotcha. I mean, it does help. I feel like there's a couple of other commentators I've talked to where like they have a background in theater and they tend to be very, you know, kind of innately like well-spoken and able to project very well. So it clearly is a good basis. I know some others have actually had a background in debate, which is kind of funny.
That's,
I feel like,
interesting.
They create, yeah, more of an argumentative is like a bad word a lot of the times, but I feel like in an interesting way it creates a lot of argumentative commentators. But yeah, theater background works out obviously very well. So you jump into this and then you get paired up with Jaws, you know, it's currently on the Overwatch League main broadcast. But then at some point You get, I mean, how long were you doing Contenders then with Jaws? I'm not sure about the timeline here.
As of this month, I think we are 50-50 split of my time with Jaws and my time with Lemon. I casted with Jaws for 2 years, and admittedly, those were a very good 2 years. Unfortunately for Lemon and I, the split happened at the end of 2019 when Jaws got picked up, and then we moved into the COVID era. So Lemon and I have had very few events comparatively in the same schedule, even though like we'd have been qualified to do them all. But yeah, Jaws and I worked together through the first year and the second, and I suppose that Jaws was present for most of my developmental cycle, whereas Lemon's been here more in the polishing stage of my casting.
And what role do you have with that duo?
I think that Lemon and I have settled into a bit more of a unique kind of hybrid style, because we both love doing both roles. Like, I enjoy doing a little bit more play-by-play. Like, when we were choosing partners, or well, not choosing partners, but when Blizzard and Jaws told me Jaws is going off to Overwatch League, I talked to him like, so I came into this game as a play-by-play, and I still kind of want to do that as well. Would I be able to opt into a play-by-play that I really want to work with long-term, or if not, can I be the one to swap the roles? And then we find a color from there. And I told Blizzard that if I was going to stay color, I really wanted to work with either Trid, who was already on the broadcast, or Lemon Kiwi, because I loved what she does. I thought she was very talented. I thought, you know what? I can work with that. That'd be a great product, mate. And they seemed very keen on Lemon. In fact, they were probably already planning Lemon and didn't even tell me. They were just like, just touching the bathwater to see how warm it was. And turned out it was pretty warm. And we started off a little bit more stiffly in terms of roles. But I think over time, we've sort of landed in a hybrid style, because Lemon is super smart about the game, and it's awesome for her to have a chance to show that off. Because everyone needs their time to get a little bit of analytics in. So especially with Contenders, like, it can be a little bit different with like a far more mainstream audience like Overwatch League has. But because Contenders is tier 2, you inherently have a more specialized audience, and you want to kind of ingratiate yourself with those hardcore people by being able to hardcore up a notch when it comes to how you're conveying the game to them. So it's been great for Lemon and I to be able to share that hardcore level of conveyance to the audience, so that we're both sort of like equally trustworthy as sources, even to put it like through a historical lens.
Yeah. I speak to a couple other people from Overwatch, and Overwatch still kind of remains the esport that I hear more often, that you kind of have to have the distinguished role. You have to have play-by-play, and you have to have color. And being a mix can be a bit confusing, just the how fast Overwatch consistently is. There really is rarely even a time where it calms down, because everyone's rezzing all the time. So even compared to Valorant, you know, you have a little bit of a lull, analyst speaks, and then play-by-play usually takes over. So did you find that you didn't have a lot of references or examples for hybrid styles, and you kind of had to make your own? Or was there someone that I missed who also does hybrid?
I think it's kind of, yeah, like just the Lemon and I thing. Like, I don't think anyone else really does coherent hybrid style. And it might turn out that if we go to Overwatch League, we have to dump it, because it can be a little bit more confusing for the audience. Like I said before, because we have a much more specialized audience, we're quite lucky in that Lemon and I are both fairly distinct as casters. To be fair, it might work at Overwatch League, just because Lemon's a Canadian woman and I'm a very British man. So the differentiating line is a little bit more easy to grasp. And like, when you've got two male commentators, especially two male commentators from like the same region who have similar voices. But Lemon and I have quite a decent amount of vocal separation there, so maybe it could carry over. But to address the regular question, there wasn't really much in terms of acute examples we could really look to. It was kind of just play it by ear. We'll look back. Was this shit? Maybe. How are we going to stop it being shit? We'll try this.
Nice, yeah. That's interesting that it also, you know, you think about the actual voice differences, which I honestly do think is something to note. I don't know if I've ever been more confused, because like, so they both have the same type of voice quality and one's analyst and one's play-by-play, but I have definitely had trouble separating two and like getting attached to a brand because of it. If I'm just new to an esport, right, and I'm like, who was that and who was that? It can actually take a little while. The amount of time that you're on screen is often very low, and people don't necessarily watch when you are on screen because that's usually the boring desk segments, right? So it is an easy way to kind of distinguish yourselves in multiple ways, including when you're actually casting and being able to hear like, oh, okay, I see what the difference is. But so you team up, Overwatch is by far the most consistent esport when it comes to forcing pairs. So other esports definitely kind of push towards pairs. But even then, there's a little more experimentation, or there's so many casters and so many tournaments, they're kind of just like, whoever, let's pick them and see what works. And there's a little bit of anti-pair pairing bias in some companies, which we can talk about later. But Overwatch, still very much you're a pair and you're going to work together for at least a year, I suppose, is kind of what it is under, right? And then if it works out, you're going to be playing with each other more than just a year. Did you latch on to this idea when you got picked with Jaws, or you got picked with Lemon Kiwi, and just went, okay, we're a duo, we're a pair, let's just do Overwatch contenders and make the best product possible? Or did you think, okay, we're a pair, we work well together, let's do everything, let's see how far we can push this?
I will answer in 1 second. I'm going to close my door because otherwise you're going to start getting some real nasty background bleed, because Dad's still on his happy celebration and now it involves music.
No worries. His dad had some good stocks recently. That's what I was told for all the listeners out there. But all
right. Right. So pairing and Overwatch. I think it's worthwhile for anyone who hasn't watched like your previous episodes of like Lemon Kiwi and such to kind of outline why pairing and Overwatch might be so prevalent. And that's the, unlike a lot of other tournament organizers or like other esports, I'm going to take CSGO as a primary example here. Overwatch is not populated with a huge amount of TOs. It's a centralized tournament structure based around Blizzard, and that means that most of the contracts for commentating are usually about a year long. Like, all of the casting contracts that I've got for contenders have been from the beginning of the year through to the end of the year's worth of events. And generally, I think that means that they're much more happy to like try and find pairs, because I feel like forcing pairs would be more difficult when different TOs could have different preferences. Whereas Blizzard's preference, to some degree, when it comes to getting hired in Overwatch, is the be-all and end-all. Like, if Blizzard don't like your product, you're not getting hired for a big gig in Overwatch. That's simply how it be. So I think that Blizzard's like to kind of nudge towards these pairings and then see if they take. Like, we've had some experimentation, and mostly when people are ill, but I guess it's all valuable data for the employers as to how people work together when they mix and match pairs. But when it comes to the mentality of a pairing, I suppose it can depend a lot upon chemistry. Like, Jules and I were very determined to make contenders the best product they could be, but I don't remember us having a huge amount of ambitions outside of contenders. Whereas with Lemon and I, because I was a little bit more sure of myself when getting into them, like, it's not a shade on Jaws. Like, at the time, like, I felt very underwhelming compared to Jaws. He was a lot more experienced than I was, so I was quite shy about suggesting other things. I felt very much like a junior partner in a relationship, as it were, almost like I was an apprentice caster. But with Lemon, it's definitely almost like it was written as equal. Lemon and I started casting at exactly the same time, and we've started doing contenders in different regions exactly the same time. So we kind of had parallel development. So it's a lot more easy for us to be able to potentially think, hey, we've developed like this, we could maybe take it over to this esport. Like, I'm really interested in joining Lemon in a little bit of Rocket League. I'd love to do maybe some Apex Legends with Lemon. And sometimes we suggest things and the other partner just isn't into the esport, like with Valorant. I was like, yo, you like Valorant? And Len was like, not really. So, fair enough. So I seek out a different casting partner there. But Lemon is generally my preference when it comes to moving between games that are like Overwatch, because she's just someone who I work really well with and we enjoy each other's company. And we try and expand partnership beyond casting as well. We go on each other's streams on Fridays and throw away each other's elo in ranked games through some very consistent inting. And I feel like it's important to generate as a duo, especially in a duo in an esport where duos generally are viewed as a singular product, like a consistent brand of entertainment. We had so many plans for content as well, because we were going to be in a studio all the way through 2020 over in Krefeld, Germany. If you know the Take TV studio, it's very famous and stuff. Oh, yeah. After the for those events. We were going to be there all the way through 2020. So we had so many plans for content there, but we never got to go. So it kind of fell through there, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. I may have lost the thread of a question.
If you had chosen to dedicate yourself as a brand and like test the waters elsewhere because you had a buddy. So I think you did answer the question. But on that same line here, did you find it easier to branch out to other esports because you had a partner, like a little bit of that, like, you know, mental help, right? You're both able to talk and be like, yeah, let's do it, as opposed to just being all alone in the waters, or just you thought that TOs actually appreciated having two of you just right from the get-go? Or do you ever think that was actually something that hindered your progress?
It's almost difficult to say just because of the context of the game we're coming from. It feels like moving out of Overwatch is always quite difficult just because of a singular tournament organizer structure. Like, you don't get to build up those sort of like networking opportunities with TOs who would work in every esports, who are like, hey, we work with these guys on Overwatch. They're pretty good there. We can give them a shot on this other game if they want to do it. But it's been very easy with Lemon, because Lemon's quite well connected compared to me. Like, to a degree, I can kind of ride on Lemon's networking coattails when it comes to other gigs. And it's maybe not as fair a relationship as I would like, because I don't bring as much to the table in terms of connections, because professionally, I've only really ever worked that much in Overwatch. So I've got, like, Blizzard know me. will that do? But Blizzard already know Lemon, so I don't bring too much to the table there. So striking out alone is quite difficult. Luckily, the casting partner that I've picked up for Valorant, Kremer, comes from CS, so he's already pretty well embedded in that tournament structure. So I suppose that essentially, Zombie, I'm a casting parasite.
That's a good description. It's not very surprising to hear that, though, and not because I have any judgment on you, but just that I did talk to Lemon Kiwi, and I remember very distinctly being impressed with how much she just was like, yeah, I just go for it. I don't understand what everyone else's problem is, was like kind of the tone that I picked up. She was like, yeah, I just emailed them and asked if they would, you know, be willing to try me out, and I just talked to that person because like we're both humans and it's not that big of a deal. And I was like, it's a good type of personality to have when a lot of other people, myself included, are just like, oh, I don't know, like, I guess I'm kind of okay, maybe I'll contact someone. Yeah. So yeah, it seems like an awesome person to be the caster parasite. You bring up this Blizzard being a single entity. There's not a whole lot as far as the other TOs go. It's very obvious now that you mention it, but I just didn't think about it. And it can be a downside. I absolutely see what you're saying. There's not that person that you know when a TO a tournament organizer that can say, yeah, I think that guy can do well. But the upside does seem to be that Blizzard and Overwatch, you know, they made it, they pushed it to the forefront of esports. They did. So whether it would have been successful regardless of Blizzard's mass amount of push is not the topic right now. It is a big esport. And it seems that if you do Overwatch League or Overwatch Contenders, you are already given a little bit of like a check mark, you know, like, wow, they do this big thing.
So I feel like that's definitely like the other side of the coin, right? Like, if you've got like a centralized authority, it's like, this guy is Gaming Corporation approved.
exactly.
Like, when you get that, like, yes, you are caster from Riot or from Blizzard or from another centralized entity that runs an esport. I don't know if EA does it. I'm not sure how ingrained EA are in, like, Apex Legends. but they also run FIFA and stuff as well. So they probably have a centralized body that's like, yes, they can go on our broadcast. I think it definitely does come with that kind of seal of quality that might not always be as universally acknowledged as, say, like getting a one-off gig from ESL. Like, ESL have some really good top-tier talent, and they also have some kind of trickle-down leagues as well, where maybe if you've got picked up for those, you don't have that kind of inherent, this person has the check mark, the caster verification. I don't know what we could call it. Yeah. But it's like the universal qualification almost. It just says, yeah, they're all right. they're not going to torpedo your broadcast.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also interesting because I did bring up that some cases, other esport organizations, they actually kind of frown on the idea of pairs a little bit. And I do think it's worth expanding on. I don't know if you're going to have many thoughts on it, but in the past, there were times when pairs were kind of seen as bad for TOs, good for casters, right? Yeah. So kind of in the line of like a union almost. Like it's good for the workers, not for the company. So, you know, a pair would get very popular and be the pair. And this happened in StarCraft, kind of still happens in StarCraft. This happened in CS as well. And I'm sure it happened a little bit in other organizations, but they're not going to say who told me or anything like that, but there have literally been people I've talked to who had said, yeah, they intentionally torpedoed our duo because they didn't want us to have that much power, basically. You know, no one wanted this situation where they had to get both of us, and if they got neither of us, then their tournament was shit. Which makes a lot of sense on the TO side. But because Blizzard is literally the only TO for Overwatch, I guess they're kind of in control. There is not a whole lot of competition. You can't go and say, well, ESL paid me this much to do it, so you know, you're going to have to also kind of consider this. Do you think that there is enough competition and flexibility with Blizzard, or is this just nothing but a downside as far as pushing yourself forward, getting better pay, getting onto the Overwatch League, right? Like, there's only so many slots there, right? So do you feel positively about this or negatively about your situation with Blizzard?
I suppose it depends on the timescale that you're looking at. Because short term, yes, Blizzard have no competition in Overwatch. Therefore, they have all the negotiating power. Like, if I'm like, okay, pay me this much or I walk, and they don't pay me and I walk, like, what am I going to do in Overwatch?
Or you're walking too, yeah.
Yeah. But on the flip side, I would point to Sideshow and Bren as a case study. Mm. Blizzard giving this much power to duos, because we don't have to worry as much about the negative backlash when it comes to the negotiating stance, means that you can build up a duo brand that is reinforced by the community. And that gives additional credence to that brand when moving between esports because of the cross-pollination of viewership. And I think that it puts you in a better negotiating position to have that brand that's been built in a fairly solid ecosystem of like the corporate, yes, and and the allowing to duo very consistently. To be able to move that to other products, it means that if you're negotiating for something like, say, if you want to go into Valorant or if you want to try CS, you might be in a better position.
Yeah. It's a good answer. Yeah. It's, and I guess the really difficult question is, you know, how do you guys see yourself advancing? Do you see yourself as a potential for future Overwatch League pickups? Because I know that's been something that's very, it's been more topsy-turvy since the first initial years of Overwatch League, where it seemed like they had locked in who they liked, and then if the only reason they would have to change is if someone left, which people did. But now there was a change up previous year and the year before that as well. COVID obviously mixed things up a whole lot, so it was very confusing to even track like who was doing what, because middle of the night time zone like type of situations. But do you think that there's enough flexibility there? Do you think that Overwatch League is your next step, or are you actually more so looking outside of Overwatch for your next esports big lucky break?
I would like to think that Overwatch League is the next step. I want it to be the next step. But the question is whether the powers that be want it to be the next step. I think that Lemon and I are definitely I think that we're a recognizable brand in Overwatch at the moment. Just to toot my own horn for a second, I think that when it comes to brands outside Overwatch as duos, I don't think anyone has as much recognition as Lemon and I that we are a pair and we are a product and we are ready to present, as it were, to another audience, like whether that be Overwatch League or a different esport. And the question is, that comes with the Overwatch League question, is Overwatch League going to cover existing? Because Overwatch League, like you said, they have the people they like, and they like to keep them. And casting is often, in the Overwatch League, more addition than subtraction. Like, the only time that people are kind of subtracted now is, like, if they move up the corporate structure into Blizzard and become sort of like an administrative or broadcast showrunner position in the Overwatch League. But the number of games usually stays the same or even decreases. And I suppose it matters, like, if you get picked up for Overwatch League, what are you making on the amount of games that you get to actually cast? Because things there are very few games and there are even more casters. So it sounds terrible to say, but is Overwatch League enough in terms of goals? Because Overwatch League is fantastic. I would give anything to cast an Overwatch League game on the broadcast. But I don't know if, as a professional who's working to live, if that is enough to sustain Lemon and I in our lifestyles. So on top of Overwatch League, we also have to look at other things. Would we do Contenders as well? Vicky Kitty does this currently. She casts both Overwatch League and Contenders. And I think that for Lemon and I, that would be a great go-to, because Lemon and I love doing Contenders. Like, we love the product itself. Like you said, a lot of esports still hasn't got into this great ladder system where you can really show off teams in a very well-coordinated manner with some solid backing from a centralized authority like Blizzard. And I love working on Contenders, so maybe I could do both, and maybe that would be good enough to get me through the year in terms of being a professional caster. I could just do things like make videos and stream and, I don't know, record audiobooks.
Yeah.
Or will it be that we have to branch out into other esports as well? And how does branching out into other esports affect how Blizzard sees us as a product? Like, do they want more exclusivity on us? It's a miasma of not knowing things and at the same time wanting to buy food.
It's true, yeah. I like how you said for our lifestyles, as if you're like living in mansions and private jets.
like this is all a set. It falls away, and outside of Red Bull that I spill and the open door with a dancing dad, it's Dubai, the entirety of Dubai. Back there. How am I supposed to sustain this on 4 Overwatch League games a year?
Exactly, yeah. But the joke aside, like, obviously we're just talking about pretty much bare minimum living, you know? That is, I guess I never really, and it's too difficult of a question to get anyone to answer, I never really knew how the tiered contracts go, because obviously, like, Uber and Mr. X seem to be doing quite nicely. They mostly do Overwatch, and actually Uber couldn't do Valorant recently, so that was a bit of an awkward depart. But then, yeah, as far as like Vicky Kitty, I know she not only does Contenders, Overwatch League, she also is doing Apex now as well. So it's like, okay, I guess there might be just a straight up different contracts, just estimating here, guys. But it's unfortunate, because one thing that did seem nice about Overwatch League when it was first even introduced as a concept was that it was nice to think you would have, let's say, 8-10 commentators that would be secure for a year, which is very difficult to find, like, literal contract-wise.
Yeah.
Like, maybe you get popular enough that you pretty sure are going to get gigs throughout the year, but never like a contract. So that was my hope, that at least Overwatch League would do that. It's a bit sad to think that that's not actually the case. You're going to have to continue playing the esports.
I think it
run around.
It's kind of in two ways. Like, I think that some of the people who've been with Overwatch League for a while are on those longer contracts. But I alluded to before, like, about the lesser number of games. Like, I think people are getting added to Overwatch League with the understanding that, hey, you can come to Overwatch League, but we've only got this many games for you. So, like, we can't generate more games for you to cast. So we'll pay you well for what you do, but the fact is, there just isn't enough work that you are going to be sustained for a year off of casting these games. Like, Blizzard aren't paying me to say this, but Contenders pays pretty well. Like, especially for a tier two product. But the reality is that it's 6 weeks of work a year. And that's awesome. For a year-long contract, I get six solid event weeks of work. Pays me quite nicely. It's a bulk of my income, and that's what I can sort of plan everything around. But it's still only 6 weeks of work in 52. And you'd have to be an amazingly lucky or incredibly frugal person to make 6 weeks of work stretch into 52 weeks of living.
Oh, fair enough. It's fair enough. It's just, I think the starry-eyed, you know, dreamer of 2015 is like, it's a bit disappointed, but it is what it is. And esports has also had to really work around this COVID thing as well, which I'm sure threw a wrench into a lot of people's plans. But I guess an easier question, and I gave you the hard question of like, what are your goals and what do you think you can do? Easier question, what are you trying to improve on? Like when you say, okay, I have this goal, it might be too far out of reach, but it's my goal. What are you doing? What are you writing down on your to-do list to actually improve and reach that goal, hopefully?
I think that understanding more esports is paramount to me. Like, I noticed that I got better at casting Overwatch when I learned a bit more of Valorant. It became easier to me when I was considering my audience to be like, oh, so this is what's different from Valorant. I just assumed that was always the case. And, like, it's weird to say it, but, like, things like penetrable walls being in tactical shooters was, like, mind-boggling to me. I always assumed cover was cover. Like, cover's fine. You sat behind that paper sheet, you're good, mate. But that these kind of mechanics that just enter my mind and start sort of, like, working as, hey, this is something that needs to be considered. Being able to learn all these other games, or at least experience other people who are very good at casting them and seeing what they focus on, has probably been a huge part of my attempt at improvement. I'd say that overall, when it comes to personal improvement, in two parts, I'd be like, I want to work on my own tone, because I could become quite a monotonous boy. I could sort of just end up kind of resident slaver with how I'm speaking. But also, I want to diversify the casters that I'm listening to as well, because I really want to hear what they focus upon and what they deem to be important and how I interpret that kind of stimuli in my own casting.
I think those are pretty important things there. I would agree also with the Valorant thing specifically. I did a week of just hardcore studying for a Valorant gig, and then 3 days after I did the gig, I did a StarCraft gig. And I could very much feel myself the whole, like, 7 hours I was casting. I was like, this is more of a Valorant mind that I'm using.
Can Zerg wall bang?
Yeah, not quite that much. But it was like a different shift. Like, I was thinking more positionally when I was watching a StarCraft game, because that's a lot of what Valorant was. So, yeah. But I think that if, you know, as long as you don't let it get too crazy and just start casting StarCraft like Valorant, which would be very difficult to do, then it does
tiny
help you.
Things like sightline control or information gathering.
Yeah. Like, everything can kind of help out. And in that same line, I think also that's why doing a lot of different roles, so hosting, stage hosting, desk hosting, color analysts, play-by-play, like, I think the more you do all of those, even, you know, as practice or as an amateur role, is also very important. So have you given any thought into expanding those roles as well? I know you've flipped between play-by-play and color at this point, but anything else you're looking at?
I did work as an analyst sort of involuntarily. but the first year of Contenders that we did, we had five cast members. We had Sam Tech Girl Wright as our host, and she's fantastic, by the way. Shout out to Sam, my esports big sister. Would never have made it without her. She taught me everything I know about dealing with cameras and just generally being on a set, as well as just living as an esports. Before I met Sam, I'm going off on a tirade here, but she's fantastic.
No problem.
Personal story time. I almost didn't get into casting because I have severe travel anxiety. And being away from home alone in a place like Ukraine, which was even more scary to me, was an absolutely terrifying prospect. But Sam was my roommate in the first like residential stint of Contenders that we did in Ukraine. And she was absolutely fantastic. She took me from crying in a bathroom in Heathrow to being fairly confident in being able to travel. So I probably should, she should be sending me invoices as a therapist. But luckily, Sam did it all for free. But I don't know if she'll do that for anyone else. What were we talking about again?
trying out different roles, hosting your analysts.
Yes, I did some analyst stuff on that stint because we had forecasters and we would just rotate the pair that was actively casting and the other two would be on the desk being analysts. So I had to dive in at the deep end. My first professional color caster cast and my first time as an analyst as well. So okay. I was kind of straight into the deep end, Terry. Figure out what you want to do. And honestly, I would like to try the desk again. I was very amateur, understandably, the first time around, and it was a pretty messy experience all in all for me until it was kind of like the end of the year when I had a load of practice at it. But I would love to do hosting. I don't get enough chances to do hosting. I really want to do stage hosting. I love interacting with the crowd because live performance is my background. Like, stage hosting just naturally appeals to me. I want to be able to interact with the crowd. I want to be able to guide them. I want to be able to bring the hype. I'm a fairly loud person when I want to be, so I feel like that could potentially factor in. Like, obviously, for me, the golden standard of stage hosting is Golden Boy. Like, I love Alex. He's amazing, and I wouldn't want to copy him, but I want to emulate the kind of energy that he brings to stage hosting in a real way. But currently, obviously, very few stage hosting gigs, as there are very few stages.
Yes. Even before COVID, there is a typical host problem is that there's only one host for almost every single tournament. I know some were starting to get two if they're particularly long broadcasts, but even then, it's I think it was a battle trying to be waged that wasn't necessarily won by hosts around the world, but they're doing okay. But stage hosting is one of those things that still elude me even. I think of being up there and like in front of the crowd, and I actually still get a little bit nervous, specifically for stage hosting. There's something about it. So I think you're one of the few people that I've talked to who is actually looking forward to the chance to do that. You should make sure people know. Because I'm guessing occasionally that is a hard role to fill, especially when it comes to, specifically finding someone in the community, which is always a big conversation because, you know, Rainbow
Gamers
Six
aren't the most, stand up in front of a crowd kind of demographic.
Yeah, yeah. And so in cases, you know, you'll find them take hosts from other scenarios or games. So Rainbow Six kind of had that with Anna, and they weren't very nice about it. And then, I mean, Dota recently had it with Frankie, and again, they weren't very nice about it. There's a lot of tribalism, it feels like, in esports, even when it comes to these roles that are supposed to be very much not about being in the community, or you don't have to, but people obviously
they're quite
like
non-technical.
Yeah, they're not bringing in the analysts. They're drawing out the analysis from people. Or they're just drawing up the crowd hype, which is also very important. Do you ever struggle with that, changing over into different esports and feeling like you're interfering on other people's turf who've been around for years and years?
I don't know if I've got far enough in another esport to really feel it yet, but I feel I've been fairly well received in terms of content pieces that I've done for Valorant. Alluding back to our earlier conversation, I think that I have an invisible check mark of kinds. Like, because obviously the biggest thing that Lemon and I did that I didn't even talk about was World Cup. Although we didn't do it together, we did it with separate duos. Lemon was with Jake, I believe, and I was with Jaws. And World Cup had a pretty huge audience. And that means that a lot of people experienced us in what were some pretty polished products. That was the last gig that Jaws and I ever did. That makes it sound a little bit more grim, but it was at the kind of apex of our curve when it came to the generation of a product. So people saw Jaws and I at the best we were going to be. People saw Lemon, the most prepped that any person has ever been for a singular gig, alongside Jake, who was also impressive. So, and Lemon was able to do a huge amount with bringing Jake into casting, even though Jake had done a couple of casting gigs before with CP. So it feels like people like vaguely recognize us. So it's like they're vaguely okay. We won't flame them yet, maybe. Nice. So we've got enough fundamentals. Mm-hmm. I've kind of made this into a duos question, but it applies for me as well, that generally flaming is not too bad. And I'm lucky that in other esports, I mostly do play-by-play. And unfortunately, people, when a guy does play-by-play, people don't expect them to be smart. They can be dumb. Like, recently we've had the conversation around, like, I think it was around Yinsu, that, like, a woman can do any role in esports and they expect her to be the top rank in the game because she's working on an esports broadcast. It doesn't matter if they're a play-by-play or a host. No, they must be the analyst. They're on a broadcast. But being a guy, hooray, I was born with a penis. I don't need to know much about the game to be able to pass my role quite effectively, thankfully, in play-by-play. And it's a pretty terrible situation for a lot of women that people don't seem to accept that some of them are going to be in different broadcast roles.
Yeah. It's actually a bit weird, in my opinion, because I was paying attention to the whole Yinsu thing as well. Listeners, like, Yinsu Collins is the Valorant host, like the Valorant host at this point.
And journalist as well. She's recently put out some really good stuff on Upcomer.
There you go. So she tweeted, you know, some guy being an idiot and a douchebag about how, like, she's not even gold or whatever it was in Valorant, and saying, like, it's not my role to be good at this game. And it created a bit of a interesting topic in, I guess, like, the Twitterverse of esports. So people came not just to defend her, but also to, like, kind of, they all came out of the woodworks to complain, basically. You know, there was a lot of just like, yep, people don't understand how the broadcast works, and it's really annoying. And it very much is. You're also right. I think that generally people expect women to be analysts or hosts. And I would say that one of the last roles that's been recognized has been actually play-by-play, which is why it was really cool talking to Lemon Kiwi a year and a half ago at this point, saying that she actually was very interested in play-by-play first and foremost. But anyways, the I wanted to go back and actually, Sam, you mentioned her and gave her a lot of credit. But you also mentioned that she gave you a lot of tips as far as the camera work. I wanted to actually know what that was.
You ever just I suppose it's about how to integrate the camera into a conversation, because okay. I'd never been on a live set with cameras before. I'd like done it in front of an audience, but generally the audience, they're there. Congratulations, audience, good job. But in the esports broadcast, like, the camera is almost a participant when it comes to the directing of your sight lines. The first day, oh man, I cringe thinking about it. I was a very direct camera starer. Here is my analytical point, audience. I'm not going to break eye contact until I'm done. And even then, I still might not break eye contact. Until the camera moves away from me, I will not be breaking this gaze. And it made it feel, obviously, very separate from the rest of the desk. I was also on the end of the desk, so the conversation would move along from, like, Sam to Jaws, and now it's leg day time. Let's talk. So Sam very much naturalized me into how to make a conversation like a human being, while also having the invisible human being over here who happens to be situated inside a camera. And she was a great guide for that. She's very experienced host, still working as a host as well. And that was very important to me. Casting with the camera, obviously there has been a huge amount of practice in, like, how to interact with a caster while you're both on camera recently, but I feel like we got it down fairly well when I was with Jaws. Levin and Kiwi and I have only got to be on camera once together, and since then it's all just been, look at the webcams, guys. Look at the webcams and smile.
Yeah. What is your fun. What is your take on what to do with the webcam casting?
So for me, what I'm actually doing right now is I'm looking at you. Mm-hmm. I put the person I'm speaking to in a little window underneath my camera so that I can vaguely look towards the camera when I'm looking at you. And that makes it a little bit more easy to interact.
Okay. Yeah, that's a pretty good idea. I know that there's some people, I kind of do more like camera staring when I'm hosting. When it comes to webcam anyways. And then when I'm casting, it's a lot less, but then I've also been watching other people And it's funny that just like, I know you're talking about offline, and I actually did have a director at one point, like, tell us straight up, like, don't ever look at the camera for like these offline events. Cause he really hated it when it felt like you were ignoring the other people. Like, it wasn't a conversation. And I was like, ah, fair enough. I still think looking at the camera can be like a good addition. But then I'm watching some like Valorant stuff, and I know that Doug just literally only looks at the camera like 100% of the time. And I actually want to interview him just to ask him how he does it, because like he'll like just be like this the entire time, and like if he has to read something on the computer, it's like, and then he's done. I'm like, why did you do that?
He's chameleon. He's got like independently swiveling eyes. One reading exactly. The script, one at the camera.
Exactly. Yeah, people have to adapt, you know. And it seems like it's also not something that I think is ever going to completely go away nowadays. Now that the companies have figured out that this is somewhat possible, I think at the very least, they're going to incorporate it into some of like the tier two and tier three events. They're going to be like, you know, I think it looks okay enough that we're doing this. Yeah. Whereas before, I think some of the big emerging esports were kind of just throwing money literally at everything, and everything had to be in studio, which is nice for experience, but not necessarily worth it. So for StarCraft, for instance, I think there might have been some intent for studio once our kind of challenger returned, but now it's like,
yeah, I think it definitely, it's opened a Pandora's box that like online broadcast is no longer the sole territory of some random broadcast.
Yeah,
that's got like a $10 budget. Like, it could exactly. be made to look pretty good. And what one of the interesting things that's actually happened in Overwatch is that we've entered a meta, an esports meta, where we actually have competing broadcast houses now rather than tournament organizers who each have their own kind of packages when it comes to generating these online tournaments. Because these guys, back in the studio era, they were kind of marginalized, they were sidelined, there was no real need in the Blizzard's overall high-tier ecosystem for them to exist, because they'd contract out the broadcast generation to studios. But now, look who's come crawling back. we've been the best at online tournament organization and broadcast for a while, and so I suppose that like three broadcast houses have kind of come out of it. One's run by Solomon, who does like a load of Avast stuff. Like Avast, obviously one of the pioneers when it comes to companion streaming, the guy who does a lot of production for that. Solomon also does production for something called Bad Pachamari League, and they've recently run some events for Florida Mayhem when it comes to online production. We have Monkey Bubble, who've ran Contenders, and they run quite a few TFT events, I think, and they are fantastic. Then we have Elo Hell, who run a couple of different Contenders regions as well. So we've entered this weird broadcast house battle royale where everyone's kind of trying to one-up each other in terms of online production. And because they're trying to one-up each other, it's an arms race of innovation. And it means that the head honchos at Blizzard are consistently seeing better and better quality online broadcasts. And it means that the line between what is a professional in-studio broadcast and what is generated from everyone's homes is quite quickly blurring in terms of where it needs to fall on sort of like the tier spectrum. Because at the moment, tier 2 to tier 1.5, they can quite comfortably be filled by an online broadcast house. And even Overwatch League, of course, that's done from people's homes with green screens and a virtual set. It's a lot more advanced, admittedly. We've got some pretty good 3D modelers over there making a virtual set, and we've got some really good camera tracking going on. I ain't going to diss anyone's After Effects. But obviously, it means that the studio is less and less necessary. So the question is, I suppose, I'm going on another tirade, where do studios innovate now to bring themselves back into the area where they can affordably be broadcast partners for lower tier tournaments? Because obviously, they're never going to be outdone when it comes to being in person for your tier one event. TI is never going to happen online. that's just a fact. But when it comes to like tier two and tier 1.5 events, like, how a broadcast studio is going to innovate in terms of both the cost that it takes to get people there and to hire them, and the technology that they use to be the clear-cut choice for a tier two event.
Yeah, that's a fascinating discussion. I didn't really expect to get into, but that is all accurate. You know, I'm thinking of all the multiple amounts of production companies, I guess you'd call them, that I'm now having to work with because they seem to be changed out for a lot of the other events that happen outside of the main Dream Hacks that we do. Mm-hmm. So I think like TSL is a tournament that happens.
Hello, Kat.
She's trying to get my water. that's been happening, and I think we've changed the company we've been working with like every single time. And there's just so much of that. People coming from offline setting who have a lot of experience there, having to make it work in online. People who are online doing pretty good products saying, hey, this is our time to shine. Maybe we can actually make something happen here. Let's slap a label on ourselves and say that we're like a legitimate company. And I think you have a lot of people who are getting a lot of really good experience as newbies in these situations. Because if your goal is to be a producer or an observer even, it felt like that was the last thing on anyone's list for events. But now, since everything's online, feels like you get a lot of actual like tier two, tier one experience, opposed to tier, you know, 5, 4, 3 type thing.
Yeah, like so it's a huge it was a big barrier that, like, I imagine a lot for independent TOs as well. Like, we're gonna take a chance on this person. Are we taking enough of a chance to buy them a plane ticket and to give them accommodation for a week? That's an expensive prospect, but. I mean, to a degree, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because with an online broadcast, you can give someone a chance, and if they're shit, you can kick them off instantly. Like, you don't have to bring them back the next day if you've got, like, other talent members who can fill that void. But at the same time, it means they get that chance, because you don't have to invest thousands of dollars in accommodation, in a flight, to give this caster who you saw in a Tier 3 tournament, who did a pretty good job, we'll give him a chance over here. And it also means that they can... partner mix a little bit as well, whether that's good or bad, we've already addressed, but it means you can just slot them into a broadcast. We don't have to go and get this established caster and the new person into the same location to be able to cast together. So I think to a degree, the change has kind of democratized broadcast to be a little bit more of an even curve of opportunity, because it took so much longer to grind up to the point where people were willing to spend that money to give you a chance. Because it wasn't just giving you a chance, it was such an investment. But now, it's a lot more easy to be given, hey, we'll give them a chance, we'll just stick them on for a day. If they're shit, they're shit. If they're great, awesome.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right about that. I think we saw some experimentation in my own StarCraft. We see it elsewhere, too. It's created some downsides, of course. Obviously, like we talked about, hosting being a job that's not very difficult to find. Yeah. Photographers, you know, there's a lot of people who do need to literally have live events to really have a job. But then I also think of, they've come to kind of expect more out of being able to say, like, you're at home, like, stop complaining. So, you know, we had five casters for an event offline that did last maybe 7-8 hours, but you're hanging with friends, you're trading off, you got your breaks, to doing 8-hour broadcasts online with only one other caster, like just the two of you.
Yeah.
And that created some of its own problems, where it's actually created kind of a very difficult, like, you know, just push new people on and expect them to work fantastic in front of no crowd, no environment, with a person they're just casting with for brand new. And I think that was actually a downside for us. And it's interesting, because there have been not just negatives from what is overall a very negative, bummer couple of years. There have been some positives. There have been some things that have worked out. But we are reaching close to the end. I just have one more question for you, actually, and that's going to be the Patreon question. So what do you think is the most important thing to do or keep in mind when working in a new game and community?
This is interesting. I would say drop the ego, but I don't know if anyone brings an ego to a new game. I feel like when you reach a certain level of, like, casting professionalism, you don't tend to expect anything from, like, an audience. Like, if like the second that I saw Alex get chewed out by the Rainbow Six community, I knew that nobody was safe, because Alex is one of the best in the world at his job, and Golden Boy was not adored by Rainbow Six. And I'm like, how do you not like the most likable man in the universe? But when it comes to moving to a new esport, that's a very interesting question. Nothing beats prep. I suppose.
Yeah.
What would you say about that? Because I could probably riff off what you think as well.
For me, like, yeah, it's a hard question to ask just as like a standalone question. But if I'm thinking of what my mindset is trying to get into a new esport, which I've only done very recently, I do think first and foremost, okay, like getting the credibility. So for me, it's saying something, how do I put this? Like making sure to know the teams, making sure to know the storylines, and being able to say like, oh, okay, yes, I am familiar with this other thing that happened in the community. I think it doesn't make you a bad commentator, but I think it's the less respect you get if you just come into a cast and you find no like community like ties. Like you can't mention any of the Reddit threads, you can't mention any of the other commentators. You know, I say, oh, you know, Yinsu said this thing, and you go, what? Who is that? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like I think that is a bad look, and thus is what I would focus on most of, is just kind of knowing the general community, coming in as if you were a fan, even if your actual fan portion of this is very reduced because you're basically trying to get a new job. So it's not like you did the same thing you did in Overwatch or I did in StarCraft, which was be a fan for years, right? And then come in and say like, I've been around, I kind of know some things. You got to do that all like in a condensed couple of weeks usually. But I think it is still important. Just
how do you feel about practice casting when it comes to moving into a new esport?
What do you mean? What do I think about it?
Like, do you often partner up with someone or grab whoever your co-caster is going to be for your event you've been hired for and, like, cast over some muted VODs? Mm.
Yeah, so I was doing that initially. So I got in through the Gallerants, and they're still very awesome. And I did that
maintained
initially.
Awesomeness.
Yes, exactly. I did that initially. We were both, you know, they were new to casting. I was new to Valorant. So we're just like, let's try and just test out things. But then I recently did it with Pastry Time, who's a very established League of Legends commentator. He was awesome at Valorant as well. And I did make sure to reach out and just like get to know him a little bit. But we didn't actually do any practice casting. I would love to. That would be my preference. My preference for getting into an esport is just like repetition of casting.
Yeah, I'm a freak when it comes to practice casting.
Yeah.
Like, I know a lot of our contemporaries and our colleagues, like, they don't see as much value in practice casting, and that's okay. But coming from a theater background, my idea of going into a show without doing a rehearsal is legitimate insanity. I'm like, how? No. I refuse. This is not improv. It's close to improv, but it's not improv. So when it comes to Valorant, I have probably got, when my co-caster is available, we are doing like 10 hours of practice cast a week because I go into it and I want to make sure when I get in front of people for the first time that I am clean. And I know exactly how the ins and outs of the casting of the game works, because another thing I didn't mention, you can't show weakness. You don't say this is your first time casting. They've got to assume you've come from a tournament that they've never heard of. You do not show weakness to the community.
Yeah.
Not like, who's that? No, I don't know this. It's my first time, guys. No, it's not. I'm a professional caster, and I've casted 40 hours of Valorant in the last 2 weeks practicing for this. So I'm a freak when it comes to practice casting, and I love to do it. And Lemon and I did a lot of this as well before when we got established as a duo. I was like, all right, Lemon, you're fantastic. We're going to be the best. And to do that, we're going to do a bunch of practice casts. We're just going to spend some time together. We even watched some comedy specials together just on Netflix to figure out what we thought was funny, what kind of sense of humor we would have and how it would meld. Like, what jokes can we do that are going to land naturally and what kind of humor doesn't really work for each other? And I suppose it's all coming down to, like, if you are starting a new game, find out who your co-caster is first and just meld, spend time with them. Because the first thing that people might notice if you've got a baseline level of competency in casting is if your chemistry with your co-caster fizzles like a flask of tepid water. Like the more you can drag people into just being in a conversation with you guys about the game, the less they'll care about how much you actually know, because if they're there, if they're part of that conversation, they can be the expert. That's fine. You come on in, audience. You be the one to impart this knowledge in chat. That's fine. So long as you're not like, there is nothing here. These guys know nothing. Like, you can come in as a third person. You can be the extra expert that we need. But I just want people to enjoy the show that me and my co-caster are putting on, because then that simply leaves the room open for the audience to sort of fill the gaps.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. The audience can come in and fill the gaps and kind of acknowledge that you're good at your thing, but you're not the best at this thing yet, but they're the best because they're Twitch chat and a bunch of GMs, of course.
Exactly. GM plus only.
Exactly. But it kind of also goes back to, you know, the saying that it's not what you say, it's how you make people feel. It's a lot of commentating. So if you come in kind of excited with a baseline knowledge and just like really work with your coworker well, that actually gets you a long way. It's a lot of what I've been advised earlier on in my years is like, it's great that you know the game, but just take a chill pill and hang out with the guys and get to know them. And that's going to actually lead to a better product.
That's what I had to learn about color casting very early.
Yeah.
Like I was presenting a thesis in rap god mode every single break. And it's like, take a chill pill. It doesn't even matter if you analyze, to be honest. Just be relatable. Relate some narratives. Make the audience feel something. I'll have them to be set up to be made to either reach nirvana or depression in the next play-by-play segment.
It's a lot to, it's not very simple as this, but it is, I think, what is first and foremost makes good commentary. Because on a technical level, there's a lot of commentators that I don't think are that great on a technical level, but doesn't matter. They're still very well loved and well respected, and arguably still do a good cast because they're just like very good friends, or they're just both really excitable, or they just both have like a super big interest in the game, like something along those lines. So
my favorite casters for Valorant are probably Tasteless and Artosis. Like, admittedly, yeah. Don't hate me, guys, I love you, but they aren't the most experienced Valorant commentators, but they are the best of friends that anyone could ever ask, and I just love listening to them. I don't care like how deep the analysis is. I'm just enjoying myself with a tall glass of esports.
Exactly. I mean, they are the best example as far as their transition over into Valorant, because especially those first two broadcasts, I listened to their first broadcast, and it was very clear to me at the very least that they both, but especially Artosis, who is usually the analyst, had only recently started getting into it. Like, it was a lot of just not even color commentating, but rather just like, oh, I can't do that. And, oh, well, that's sick play. And, you know, and then eventually I think they got time to actually study and look into it. But you still can't compare them to someone like Pansy, who is not just like ingrained in Valorant, but she also did CS, which is still the most relatable thing. But anyways, not to, you know, inadvertently make this a 90-minute broadcast. got it here.
Unlucky.
Yeah, but thank you very much again for coming on. So where can people find you? What are you going to be doing in the next couple of weeks?
I am at Leg Day on Twitter. I got the clean handle. Thank you very much, Twitter. I'm Leg Day Gaming on Twitch. I stream quite a bit, actually, mostly streaming Overwatch, but I also do a little bit of Valorant. And I'm Leg Day on YouTube as well, where I do quite a menagerie of things. At the moment, I'm trying to work on a longer internet historian style documentary on the beginning fall and then the rise again of the Shanghai Dragons. But I'd say, weirdly, even though my job is casting, my main passion is comedy. And I try to confer that on my YouTube as much as possible, because eventually I'd like to be known as a funny commentator.
That is so difficult, man.
Yeah, it's so difficult just because humor's so subjective, but I try and confer that quite a bit on my YouTube. It's pretty high production value in terms of just, like, shit that gets spat out by esports people. Like, there's some really good editing in there that I spent a lot of time on, and it's all pretty high-quality stuff. So if you want to have a look, it covers Overwatch and Valorant as well.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely take a look, guys. And as for the ending, just big thank you to our co-producer Shane for the podcast, Cast Call to Zombie Grub. And thank you to everyone who supports over on the Patreon, patreon.com/zombiegrub. So Nick, Vinny, Steven, E.T., and Ruby, thank you guys very much for the extra support. Hope you guys enjoyed the podcast, and I look forward to seeing you back here in 2 weeks for yet another episode. Bye, guys.